Hello and welcome to the very first Brunel Questions. I'm Ben Moxie and I'm usually joined by Alex Mitchell, but he can't make it at the moment. This week we are interviewing Andy Burnham, who is the current Shadow Secretary of State for Education. Previously he was the Shadow Secretary of State for Health. Before the 2010 general election, was also the Secretary of State for Health and Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport. He's the MP for Lee and also was a candidate in the 2010 Labour leadership election. The very first question we asked him was, did he have any political heroes or villains?
Political hero, Nye Bevan. It's a massive privilege to be Health Secretary, a Labour Health Secretary, and I was always very conscious of the footsteps in which I was following. And I read a lot of Nye Bevan's speeches leading up to the creation of the National Health Service and then bringing it into being. And I think that is the single most impressive thing achieved in politics, and I very much... tried to take my lead from Nye Bevan. I, as Health Secretary, proposed a national care service, which obviously had echoes of the creation of the Health Service, and drew my inspiration from there. In terms of villains, oh God, where to? There's a long list of culprits there. I remember the 80s vividly. I remember being at school under Maggie, and you know all of that entailed. And there are many things I won't forgive her for.
Next question we asked Andy was whether he thought that we could introduce an NHS today, given the problems that President Obama's had over in America introducing his social healthcare bill.
I think that's a very interesting question, and I'm tempted to say no, actually. I experienced firsthand how hard it is to make the argument for a similarly transformational change in social care. You know, where we develop, go to a new type of system in terms of everybody contributing, and it's a hard thing to do. It's not impossible, but I think perhaps today's generation of politicians are less bold, and we need to get back into that spirit of proposing radical social change, because at the end of the day, that's what politics is about. And I think it's partly because, you know, the post-war period, there was the air of possibility must have been huge, you know, and it was the time to make those kind of changes. But politics in this country needs to get back a bit more to that, you know, less about incremental change, more about big, bold, inspiring change that might remind people out there that politics is important and can change lives.
The penultimate question in this political get-to-know-you session was, we asked Andy Burnham what his most proud moment in office was. It could have been something personal, it could have been something political.
It's actually something that's more on a personal level that I thought I'd never be able to achieve, but in the end we did. People may remember or not, but I was Culture Secretary when the 20th anniversary of the Hillsborough Stadium disaster occurred. And as somebody born in Liverpool, family from Liverpool, I knew how difficult that was going to be, and I knew how raw the sense of injustice was and still is on Merseyside in relation to Hillsborough. So I went there and it was a difficult day, but I knew it would be. But coming out of it, I was able to persuade the then Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, to reopen the whole question and establish the Hillsborough Independent Panel, which will now oversee the disclosure of documents. And for me, you know, it's actually not the other policy things I was involved in. That is the most single most significant and important thing to me, because I care about Hillsborough more than any other issue. I was at the other semi-final that day. I'm an Everton supporter, and as lots of people did in the Northwest, lots of friends who were at Hillsborough, and obviously there were the 96 who tragically lost everything, but there were just so many other people who were deeply scarred psychologically by the experience, and you know, the kind of collective damage that it did to a whole community, a whole generation, was just massive. And really, it was like the end of an era in British society where the authorities could basically just stitch everything up and shaft the punters, basically. And that's what I felt happened, you know, that people in authority basically didn't want to give any credence or credibility to anything that the football supporters were saying. And it was an era when they could almost get away with that. But actually, you know, what we're now doing is obviously bringing the FOI principles to that, I would say, that kind of British stitch-up of the 80s, and reopening some of those questions. And, you know, I'm very, very proud of that.
And the final question we had before we move on to the student protests. During the last few days of the Blair Premiership, we wanted to know if he was a Blairite or a Brownite.
Well, I was both. I supported both with everything that I had, because I suppose I'm instinctively a Labour loyalist. So therefore, my loyalty went to the leader of the Labour Party. I've never been actually somebody who is factional in terms of my politics. So I never really enjoyed that whole Blairite versus Brownite thing. I mean, I never really played that particular game, to be honest. And I think those that did damaged the Labour Party. Tony Blair had many great strengths, in my view, as did Gordon Brown. They both did great things for the Labour Party. And, you know, I've got tremendous respect and affection for both of them. But actually, you know, my loyalties to them were very much driven because of my overriding loyalty to Labour.
Now we come to the main body of the interview, the student protests. They've been taking place over mainly November, but into December as well. They received a lot of press, and we asked him whether he was pleased to see that students are taking a stand for their beliefs, even if the bill won't directly affect them.
Yes, it is. Obviously, those demonstrating peacefully, I think there is important to make that divide. But absolutely, yes, really. And I think perhaps some people might look at this debate and think, oh, are they voting over, is it 6,000, is it 9,000? Actually, not. I think the reason why people are so angry is it's a bigger question, isn't it, about what kind of education system do we want in this country and who will it be available to? And I think that is what people are also, or mainly in fact, protesting about. It's not necessarily the individual effect on their situation. And that, I think, is what's so inspiring about it. It's a kind of protest against a more elitist education system, which I believe the coalition are cracking about creating. And that's why I think, you know, I'm full of admiration for the strength and the passion with which people have mounted their argument.
When Labour were in power, they had a policy of 50% of all students to go to having 50% of all students to go to university. We asked him whether he thought that was an attainable target or not.
No, I think it is attainable. And, you know, I think we made great progress towards it. You know, we got into the low 40s, I think, by the time Labour left office. And I feel a university education should be within reach of everybody, and actually is best equipped people for the world as it is today, because, you know, the world isn't as traditional and as clear in terms of career choices. You know, I think young people today have to be all-rounders. They have to be entrepreneurial. They have to have the ability to, you know, to switch and to think laterally. And a university education gives you that ability, an all-round academic and intellectual confidence that it does equip you for the much more challenging world that we have today and the more competitive world. But the other side of what you're pointing to in your question, I think, is also true. We have to do a much better job at thinking through the options for the 50% of young people who don't plan to go to university. And I think in politics and in society, we are all collectively culpable of not doing enough to think through high-quality opportunities for young people who want to go into skills-based learning or who want to go into the world of work more quickly. And I want to correct that failing in this job as Shadow Education Secretary. I want to focus more now on the life chances of the 50% of young people who don't plan to go to university.
But where does it leave the other 50%? Is it wrong to assume that every single student is going to go to university after A-levels?
No, I'm certainly somebody who wants to raise expectations and aspiration in particularly, you know, the former industrial parts of this country where they tend to be lowest. And, you know, building the expectation amongst those young people that they should think of university is I think, a good thing. It's what my mum and dad did for me. They didn't go to university. No one in their family had ever been to university before. But in a very supportive way, they started to talk to us, me and my brothers, when we were young, about they wanted us to go to university. They didn't do it in a pushy way, but they kind of they lifted that expectation. And I, you know, for me, I would always be grateful for that. And I think people with backgrounds like mine need that kind of that support from an early age to think that university is for them. And I think one of the most corrosive things about the Brown report and the government's response to it is I can imagine in living rooms across the Northwest on the day that the 6 o'clock news reported those issues, you know, dads turning to kids in the living room saying, well, you may as well forget about university. It's out of the reach of the likes of us now. And that is actually the most damaging part of it. So I think it is right to raise the thought that university is for everybody. But I do also, though, think that you also have to, though, be clearer about different approaches to learning and work-based learning and apprenticeships and raise the status of them. They are still too much the kind of second-class option. I think the government's education reforms are likely to cement them in that position, and I'm worried about that, very, very worried about that.
Whenever you talk about tuition fees and education at university, it's always going to come back to the bottom line of the actual cost of tuition. When we did the interview, obviously it was £3,000, roughly, now a maximum of £9,000, and what we asked him was, as Shadow Secretary of State for Education, where would he put the figure on university education?
For me, it's got to be a partnership. So university benefits both the individual who goes in terms of the passport to more likely higher earnings in the rest of their life, but society also benefits from a university-educated workforce. So society should contribute. So my judgment is, you know, actually, Labour, though we had our own difficulties on this issue, came to the right position, which is that the funding of higher education should be a partnership between the individual and the state. And actually, I think you should probably work towards a 50-50 partnership. And then you want a system whereby the way the individual repays that contribution is as progressive as it possibly can be to enable people from all backgrounds to take advantage of university. Now, that, for me, is the right policy to have. I think the catastrophic error of judgment that the coalition have made is to take a huge leap towards a private university system where the onus of paying for it is fully on the back of the individual. Now, for the Liberal Democrats, it seems to me, that is a complete about turn from where they were arguing for fully funded university. For me, Labour should stay where it is on that ground, a partnership, 50-50 as much as it can be. And obviously, fees would have to rise progressively over time to keep that balance in place. What is utterly wrong about what's being proposed is this 80% cut to the teaching grant, which essentially is just removing the state from the sponsorship of humanities courses, of arts courses, and that is profoundly wrong. It is, as Ed Miliband said, cultural vandalism, because it doesn't recognise how the studying of those subjects by people of all backgrounds enriches our whole society.
Something else we asked him was, in the run-up to the general election in 2010, all we heard at university was Lib Dem, Lib Dem, Lib Dem, with their, now as it turns out, fatuous promise of eradicating the tuition fees. What I asked him is, why didn't we hear anything from Labour in the run-up to the election? Why were they so quiet on their policy?
Yeah, maybe when we look back at that, we should have been clearer about that, and perhaps have been clearer about the big picture options to take the system further forward. And graduate tax is an idea that is gaining currency now in Labour circles. It certainly did during the Labour leadership campaign, and perhaps we didn't anticipate how quickly this issue was going to come upon us with the response to the Brown review. Possibly also we didn't do enough to celebrate the good things that we did in government. For instance, the educational maintenance allowance. EMA, I think, has been such an important policy intervention to open up opportunities to young people, particularly those who have leased and come from the less well-off homes. You know, EMA has actually been a lifeline to them to being able to even think about university. And I know, what I think has been so good about the protests so far is that they've actually have not just been about fees. They've linked these two issues together because the scrapping of EMA or the shrinking back of EMA to a tiny, tiny safety net scheme is actually as pernicious to the life chances of many young people in this country as the exorbitant rise in fees. So Labour perhaps didn't celebrate enough EMA, our commitment to it, the fact that we brought it through and how it had changed people's routes into higher education. And we've got to learn from that.
Next, we asked him a brief question on whether he could explain to us the process that would happen on the 9th of December regarding the parliamentary vote.
Well, there's going to be two votes tomorrow. Firstly, there'll be a vote on what we call, the programme motion or the business motion, which will be about the time that's been allotted to this debate. We do not think it does the issue justice. I think the allocation is 3 hours. Obviously, there'll be a much greater appetite to speak in the debate. So the first vote that John Denham will call for will be a vote on that timetabling of the debate. But then obviously we will then get into the substantive debate, and essentially what we're debating tomorrow is an order, quite a short instrument, if you like, in terms of parliamentary terms, that basically alters the cap, the 3,000 cap on fees. And that will be the substantive vote tomorrow. Labour will vote against that, and I'm actually proud that we're doing that. You know, it actually gives us an opportunity now to explain afresh what we did, why we did it, but also say these are lines over which we should not cross. And as I say, if we do, and if the coalition win the vote tomorrow, it's not just the direct effect on students, which is bad enough. It's the kind of education system they're building for the rest of this century, and that is what worries me intensely.
If you look at the cross-section of the House of Commons, the majority of the people in there had free education, free university education. We asked him, did he think it was quite galling to all students that those people debating on whether they were going to have higher fees had never paid for education in their lives?
Yeah, I could see how it's utterly galling to people out protesting, because they will think, you know, here we are, speaking about things which matter greatly to us, trying to influence MPs, but also feeling, do they really understand what we're campaigning about and why we feel it so strongly? To be fair to, you know, many MPs, many will have had kids that have gone through the university system in recent times, so it's not, you know, as completely as you say. You're right, many did go through a fully free university system and draw their experience from that, from those memories. From my point of view, I was at university when the first student loans came in, so I did have a student loan, which obviously was paying some of my living expenses rather than tuition fees. I got a full grant at the time, and you know, obviously fully funded. But yeah, I absolutely recognise that. And you know, I was involved in the activity. Yeah, we there was a huge campaign back then in the early 1990s against student loans, and I was involved in that. So, you know, I hope people can see today's generation do have some, you know, some understanding of the anger that people are feeling.
As mentioned at the start of the interview, Andy recently stood for leader of the Labour Party in the recent election after Gordon Brown stood down, and we asked him to speak of his own experiences of being in that race.
Yeah, there were lots of ups and downs. It was, it was a hard road, and you know, I had to dig deeper than I've ever done before in terms of the sheer energy levels that were needed. But you know, I don't regret for one moment having stood, because you know, as somebody who perhaps was seen as being, as I said earlier in the interview, a loyalist, and you know, always being the party man and doing, you know, the supportive thing, and being the minister who always went out and no matter how tough times were, being on message, it actually was incredibly invigorating for me to speak in, you know, my own words about where I thought Labour had lost its way and how it had lost touch with, as I described it, ordinary working people. And you know, for me as a politician, that has been an incredibly empowering experience, actually, because I spoke for myself, I spoke for nobody else, I said it as I wanted to say it. I obviously didn't connect with enough people, but I connected with a few people for whom my voice in the race meant something. You know, it was the voice they wanted to hear in the race, because they wanted to hear that perspective reflected as Labour debated its future. So I've got no regrets. It was a hard thing to do. I'm glad I did it. I now fully support Ed, and I'm helping him reshape Labour for new times.
At the time of the interview, it was 74 days since Ed Miliband took office, and we asked him how he thinks he's done in those first 74.
I think he's done really, really well, and you know, I think the criticism of him for taking his paternity leave was absolutely out of order. I also know from my own point of view, coming through what we all went through, you know, this year, a general election, a leadership election, and then into, for him, you know, going on to, I think he's done exceptionally well. And in a calm, in a clear and a measured way, has put down some clear principles about how he wants to change Labour. And, you know, there's always going to be voices, you know, muttering away. But actually, you know, I think he's taking his time to get things right. He's listening. And, you know, I think Ed's going to be a great leader of the Labour Party.
Finally, and we're going to do these questions with every single politician we have in, what was your most embarrassing moment in politics?
I always get worried when people do the quick-fire questions. This is the danger point, as I remember from the leadership election. God, there have been loads, actually. There was the thing in the, you know, the expenses, the whole thing was a nightmare, obviously, but when they published a letter I'd written about my wife divorcing me if I didn't get reimbursement, and that was quite embarrassing, actually. And that'll teach me to ever try. Like, as with Liam Byrne, jokey private notes never work well when they're in the newspapers. I think that's what I learned from that experience.
What would you say is his worst trait?
Lateness. I think everyone would. There's general nods around the office that people. General nods of agreement around the office here. But the funny thing about being a politician is your time is kind of soaked up by everybody. You know, in that, you know, the media say, well, we need an interview, we need it now. And or somebody stops you and when you're walking somewhere and says, oh, I must talk to you about X. And actually, it is quite hard as a politician both to be available to people and, you know, and then always on time anyway. I've never managed it in 10 years of being an MP.
If you could have one superpower, what would it be?
Probably to become invisible. Yeah, you know, you're in an horrible position and you think all of a sudden, oh, get me out of here, you know. So,
we also wanted to know, what was his favourite book?
Ooh, that's a good question. I studied English at university, so I didn't study politics. And I'm actually quite glad I did that. You know, I think command of English is something that I'm not saying I'm necessarily I've got it in every respect, but I think the fact that I had an English literature background, I think stands me in good stead in politics. So what is my favourite book? 20th century poetry is something that I'm very interested in. So Tony Harrison's collected poems, I would recommend it to anybody.
And the final question we asked him was, what is his political ambition?
My ambition, you know, it's actually quite a simple ambition. I want to pass on Lee as a safe Labour seat. So when I've had my turn, and I'm not one of those politicians who are going to be carrying me out of here when I'm in my 90s. I'm going to do a good stint as MP for Lee, but then there will come a time to say, well, let somebody else have a go. I want to pass it on in good shape as a constituency that could say that I was a good MP for Lee. And actually, because of that, you know, the Labour flame is still alive and strong, and it's there for a new generation, a new person to take on. And it might be a simple ambition and maybe a low-level ambition, but to be honest, that, more than anything, would make me happy and fulfilled in life.